Good afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And today we have a lot of people.
We're having a party.
We are, kind of.
Yeah.
A sad party, but we're having a little party. So let's see, there are six of us in here, but it is January 25th, 2026, and it is the day after Congressman Doug LaMalfa's memorial service. And so we thought, well, we had two of our guys from Washington, D.C., one who was going to be here, one who was trapped because of the airlines. No, was it a storm? So we have those two guys here. So we have George. Say something, George, then they'll know what you sound like.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, and he's from Georgia, so don't try to pretend you're not from Georgia. You'll know he's the guy from Georgia. And then we have Sam.
Sam, the Sham, and the Pharaohs.
Oh, yeah, that's true. What's your nickname, George? Did Doug give you one?
Yeah, so he gave me the nickname Jungle George during the job interview, and then I made a crass heroin joke when I didn't know he was standing behind me later, and so he changed it to Junkie George, and he'd use it interchangeably. Oh,
nice. Okay, I never knew that.
Uh-huh. It was based on how he viewed me for the day. So if he called me Jungle George, then he was happy with me. If he called me Junkie George, I'd done something wrong.
Dang. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. I'm kind of glad we didn't know that already. That's super fun. And Sam, of course, we had to educate him on Little Red Riding Hood was their best song, but Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs. And then we have Brenda, a.k.a.
Bun Bun.
Bun Bun. She's always been Bun Bun. So Brenda Haynes, and you probably know her because she, if you live in the Reading area, she's in our district office here. Back to Sam. Sam comes from Anderson. He was our intern back in
2014, maybe?
Yeah. Maybe sooner than that. It's been a really long time.
Yeah.
When he was in high school. And now he works in legislative stuff at the office in Washington. Brenda does field stuff and has for
23 years total, counting back to the assembly days.
Mm-hmm. Crazy. Laura, are you speaking?
Sure.
You have to swivel her over.
Laura, also known as a Dougism as Lara, or Landslide Lara.
Oh, that's right, because she got her Central Committee seat by, what, three votes? He called her Landslide Laura. I forgot about that.
Finally settled on Bella's mom.
Oh, yeah, because her daughter works in the D.C. office. I was always Air Bear. We don't know really where that came from. I think it was just a rhyming thing. And Bill?
Oh, just Willis.
He was Willis.
Hello, Willis.
Doug was really big on nicknames.
Yes, he was.
So we thought we would, I don't know, I don't know if allowed is the right word, but we never did this when Doug was here because borderline inappropriate. Like, a lot of the stuff we do, obviously, is private constituent work and all that. But there's funny stuff that goes along the way. Lots of funny stuff. So I have put together a page for today. Anybody who missed the memorial service yesterday, didn't attend, didn't watch, which was, I'm sure, probably a fair amount of people, although there were 3,000 people there, which was...
Yeah, it was huge.
Enormous. If you would like to watch it before we kind of get rolling along here, I have it on the page for today. So if you go to wethepeopleradio.us to the January 25th, 2026 entry, if you're listening to this later, I've got the full video of the service, and then I took some clips out of, like, highlights. We're going to play little deals out of them later on, but Doug's wife did an amazing tribute with her kids that you should listen to. Our chief of staff, Mark Spanagel, he did a really nice job. House Speaker Mike Johnson, I have him on there. I have Doug's cousin. Doug's cousin, it says a cousin tells all or something like that is the name of the clip, but the cousin story was really noteworthy because it was kind of a soup to nuts, start to finish backstory of like how
Doug, from when they were kids all the way up. Yeah.
All the way up. And then Kevin McCarthy, who served with Doug for his entire political career in various forms or fashions, he did an amazing job as well. And I'll add more clips, but Microsoft conspired to destroy my computer, and that was as good as I could get for you by today. But I will add more later. So what else are we missing? I guess I should turn my phone off, huh? So whoever just texted me, thanks for that. No, my phone's still on. And everybody's moving now. Go ahead and try to fix my microphone. It can't be fixed. There's something wrong with it. There's something wrong with everything today. You guys noticing that? The world is just a little dimmer today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, thank God. Thanks, Bill. Use those man hands and tighten the screw on the microphone. Thank you. All right, where do you guys want to start?
Well, I was just really impressed with the organization they did putting this whole thing together. I mean, they had to employ, I think, 4 buses, maybe 5 buses, to get people there at the right times. And then they had a ton of people, probably 1,000 people showed up in cars that were in a separate overflow building. But so many people, and everything went off without a hitch. And then the security from the staging area, the traffic, they had streets blocked off for all the buses. They had escorts. They had snipers on the roofs, SWAT teams. I mean, it was everywhere you looked, it was going to stay under control. It was pretty amazing.
Okay, so survey. How many police do you guys think were there of all forms or fashions? I mean, you had, and there were some we didn't see.
Yeah.
But there were lots of guys with the squiggle thing behind their ear that you could tell because they don't smile. They really should teach them how to smile. They would blend in better. But the non-smilers, there were a lot of those. A lot of no-smilers.
Oh, yeah. There was.
I mean, hundreds of law enforcement.
Yeah, easy 300. Like, probably more, but easy 300.
That's what I was going to guess, was about 300.
Yeah, everywhere you looked.
Cal Fire was there as well.
Yeah. Oh, you're right.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so you had Chico Police, you had, I'm sure, Reading Police, you had State Police, you had really all levels, which was really great because we had, I didn't write it down, but how many members of Congress?
Oh. Anybody? 40.
Yeah, about 40 members of Congress.
And that's even considering that a bunch of them got stuck in the snow in D.C. and want to do something in D.C., so they're already planning something else. When we all go back,
I'm not in charge of that guest list, though.
No,
I'm just going to put that,
put that down
right
that's
now.
That's been foisted on me.
So, has it?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's really
God.
Cool.
Well, Sam, I can tell you should sleep now and eat now in preparation for your great task.
Well, another interesting thing was when you speak about the members of Congress, they actually flew into Beale Air Force Base on Air Force Two. And
I have a clip about that, but I can't play it because I can't communicate.
They got their own airport, everything, and they got there. I think they got there before everybody else because they were there when we got there.
Yeah,
and, that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, and I don't know. Doug was not a guy that was lobbied easily. He refused to be lobbied pretty often. So I would go to these. You know, the fundraisers, a lot of lobbyists have reached out trying to go to his funeral because rather than lobbying him, they were just friends with him, or he taught them how to repair a car or something. So all these random, you know, rail car association lobbyists and charter school people who are like, hey, so like, I can't go back to California for the funeral, so when are we doing something? And if you're not doing something, we'll do something. So it's just been sort of a testament to how many people wanted to be there or wanted to be at something. I probably have like 300 text messages from random DC folks who just want to do a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But over the years, okay. So over the years, there are lots of people who are, people think, oh, so-and-so is so incredibly important and everyone loves them, blah, blah, blah. But really, they're just media hogs. Doug hated doing that. And if something great, George should speak to this because he tried to be the media guy for a while, which was really like running uphill every day.
I gave it a good attempt.
No, you did, but Doug was tough about that.
Oh, yeah, he was.
Because he didn't want to be like, oh, hey, look at me, I did this big thing, and...
Yeah, that was Doug.
Well, that's not very... Tell us more. Tell us more, George. Don't make me call you Junkie George.
No, please.
Be Jungle George for us today.
I remember during my first interview with him, he was very adamant. He's like, I want to sound like someone who's listening to the radio in their garage can hear me speak and understand without any of the extra bells and whistles. And so he reaches behind him and he produces this whiteboard that has about 20 random words on it. And he was like, what do you think this is? And 23-year-old, fresh out of an SEC school with no idea what the heck he's doing me, is still trying to get past the fact that I am talking to a sitting U.S. congressman. And so I just go, I have no idea. And he's like, tranche, this word. I don't like it. Don't ever use it.
Tranche.
And so as I...
Tranche was a super big pet peeve.
It was a huge pet peeve. I mean, I never used it anyways. But as I stayed on and as I worked with him, the list of words that were forbidden would get longer and longer. And it got to a point where I had to sit down with him and I just said, Chief, I'm going to be honest with you. We're getting too far here, I think, and now I'm trying to like piece together very like complex sentences with very weird words that I'm pulling out of the thesaurus because I can't use simple things like fight or community. Yeah.
Try to write a letter of support for a fire resilience project for a forested community without using the word resilience or community. I don't know a single person who has used the word municipalities in day-to-day, and both George and I would have to, instead of saying, you know, our towns, we'd have to say, you know, many municipalities, which municipalities is a clunky word, right? But it wasn't community, so it was allowed.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I still think that he would hear someone that he didn't like say a word, and he'd be like, I'll be caught dead before I ever say something like that.
So we have access. I have the picture. I have the whiteboard. Access, backbone, bad actor.
Mm-hmm. I remember that one.
Do you? Mm-hmm. Where'd that come from?
Bad actor was basically just one morning. He had seen someone say it on TV, and it had just... He was just in a mood about it, and so he comes into the back office, and he's like, Junkie George. And I was like, oh, and I was like, it's 9 o'clock. What did I do already? And so I just turn around, and I'm like, yes, Chief? And he's like, put bad actor on that whiteboard. And I was like, both bad actors that you put it on there. And I don't ever use it. Don't ever use it. Yes, sir. I'll put it on right now.
He one day came in and it was rubric. He came in, he heard somebody use it on the cell phone on the plane, some like corporate like lawyer or something. And he literally, the door came open, he said, hey kids, like he did every single time he came into DC, but usually he would sit around and talk to us. He went straight to the back of the room, pointed at the board, and was like, rubric, put it on there. and then he turned to everybody, and he made us each. He said, what do you think a rubric is? And he made everybody answer, and everybody had a different answer. And so he was like, see? Nobody knows. But it needs to be on the board. Yeah, but rubric, he said, generally, if you could imagine a politician with their thumb over their fist, like, looking out into a crowd, sort of moving their hand with their thumb over their fist, saying the word, it should be on the board. And we hadn't discovered all of them yet.
The phrase, there is no place for it, dot, dot, dot.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's on
here. He hated that one.
What's Einstein quote?
Oh goodness.
Because that's all it says on the board is Einstein quote. So there must have been a certain Einstein quote.
I'm trying to remember.
We both didn't use it.
Yeah, we both didn't use it. I know that much.
Stay away from Einstein.
Debris.
Yeah.
Debris was bad.
Try writing about, wildfire recovery
with no debris.
Clearing away debris. Yeah.
Huh.
No.
Clearing away fallen trees, uprooted limbs.
Oh, embolden and empower.
Yeah.
No. I remember, I am responsible for the creation of the embolden entry. That was a big black mark. See, sometimes I would use these words, and I think he already was like, I don't like it. But see, he wouldn't have, like, it wouldn't have manifested on the board yet, so I would draft something. And then he'd read it and be like, I don't like this word. I don't like this word. We don't use this word. And I'd be like, okay, well, you know, I cannot read your mind. So I'm just trying to go with what I got.
Yeah.
Let's see. Do not hesitate.
Yeah. Do not hesitate to reach out to me or my office. He hated that. He was like, who's hesitating? There's no hesitating happening.
Men and women. That was from my job interview when he was pointing his Nerf gun at me, and he was like, it's December, because I was interviewing December 7th, 2022, and he's like, it's Pearl Harbor Day, so if you got this job, what would your post about it be? And so I just, you know, still scared out of my wits, just start rambling off about December 7th, and then I said, we should always support our brave men and women in uniform, and he just kind of scowled at me and shook his head. And it's like, I don't know, brave men and women. I don't like that phrase. And so that was my first time beating
trope.
Beating Joe Blue.
Oh, yeah.
Trope was out.
Had to go with boys and girls.
Yeah. Stakeholders.
Yeah, stakeholders.
Hated the stakeholder thing.
Yeah.
We did a. Was telling George last night on the way home. We did a thing up in Wairika about the dams, and a new day. Doug hated stakeholders so much, and we were kind of laughing about it. So we decided, hey, we're going to go over to the nursery, over to Terry's nursery. So we got a huge pile of stakes, like that you would use to mark out property or whatever. So everybody had a wooden stake. So we were the stakeholders. We took all sorts of pictures as stakeholders, which was funny. Oh, robust.
Yes.
How could we have forgotten that one? New normal. Hated that one. Oh, here's rubric. It's kind of in small.
Well, the list got longer, and the confines of the small size of the whiteboard
grapple.
Required the words to get smaller.
We're all grappling with
grapple.
Tough times.
Yeah, hated grapple. How did Experience get on there?
He got tired. Is Experience and Journey. People would, you know.
Oh, yeah,
In your
and Journey's on here, too.
In your weight loss journey, or in my, you know, I remember the experience when he was like, everything's an experience now, right? He's like, we don't need to say that. You know, if you go hike a mountain, you don't have a mountain hiking experience. You hiked a mountain. Like, just tell me about it. I think he made me write Experience on the board. Sometimes us in the DC office, you know, like a congressman is busy, and then he was extra busy, and also didn't want to, always listen to us, and so sometimes to make sure he was actually reading our emails, we would send him really long sentences with as many of those words as we could fill
in. Just to see if you get a provoke a response.
I have a quick one. What do you think of My Truth?
Oh.
That didn't even make the board. It wasn't even an option.
There was no My Truth. There was no Our Truth. There was only the truth.
Heaven help the DC staffer who used the phrase My Truth unironically.
Could you imagine that? They don't get the Nerf gun or the nickname in
Christ
the interview.
Christ himself could walk through that door. He ain't going to help you.
You would go out the window. But I remember one of the first times I was nervous, I had like a bunch of bills that I needed to sign off on, and he was in California for a long time. And He wasn't taking my phone calls. He wasn't answering my texts. He was sending me Instagram memes
of cats and dogs. Yeah, he loved the animal ones.
With
funny things.
With me, it was mostly tanks and the Beatles. He would send me like Beatles like clips, and then he would send me videos of tanks, and he would just say, "Pretty cool, man." Which I don't know, that became sort of a thing with us. But one time I needed an answer on these four or five bills, and so the header of the email was a robust tranche of bills for our community. And I got an answer in like 5 minutes. And the answer was the real answer, and then in like below everything, he was like, "Are you trying to get fired, or is this like a bit?"
Sorta.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Hey, so Alex, how are we doing on our clips from our audio, or should we take a break?
I have to, like, switch the mics back and forth. So
no worries.
I do have Speaker Johnson up. Hang on, let me find it.
Oh. We could play him and then...
Okay.
You could snag some music on the back, whatever you want, and then...
Yeah, we'll have the Beatles go out with us.
Yes, oh, and then we will be right back after that. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Oh,
Speaker Mike Johnson.
So colleagues have been saying those kinds of things, sharing the stories and anecdotes for the last few weeks, and so have others. We on the plane today on Air Force Two, we brought a group of young House floor staff members. They wanted to be on the flight. They wanted to be here to pay their respects. You know why? Because they looked up to Doug as a mentor and a father figure. They wanted to fly all the way across the country just to be here and pay their respects. It goes across the community, across the Capitol. I was told a story on the plane over here. One of our colleagues said that one of the sweet ladies that serves us, she sits in the information desk in the tunnel that goes between the Capitol and the House office buildings. And this friend of ours said that she was sitting there last week in tears because she so missed the gentle giant that took the time to stop and smile and use his nickname for her and see how her day was going. That's the kind of guy he was.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone, and some remain. All these places have their moments. With lovers and friends, I still can recall. Some are living. In my life, I've loved them all.
Well, I walk back down. No, I walk back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I walk back down. No, I
fitting. So we have a list of music. We'll get to that.
So
Sam got a phone in.
Live from a listener, Mrs. Grace in our DC office. The Einstein quote is the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. We were forbidden from using that.
Because we all knew that already?
We all knew that. And also I think he determined that was a misattributed quote.
Oh.
There were a lot of things like that where he was like, he didn't even say that, and so you couldn't use it. But that was the Einstein quote.
Nice. There were always, well, so way back. Let's go to the Wayback Machine. So in the Wayback Machine, 23 years ago, so this is Bun Bun. How did you meet him?
I met him in March of 2002, and my husband and I had gone to a Shasta County Farm Bureau spring social, they called it, and it was really big in those days, and the whole bottom floor of the Civic Auditorium was just tables of people. And I was cutting through the crowd to go check my silent auction bid, and our sheriff at the time, Jim Pope, wonderful man, he said, Brenda, come here. I want to introduce you to this guy. And I remember looking up at this 6'5" guy and shaking his hand and said, nice to meet you. And I took him over to our table and introduced him to my husband and the folks at that table. And that started a process. My husband and I thought, well, if this guy is going to literally get off the tractor and go to Sacramento, we're going to help him. We'll help on your campaign. And we didn't know what a campaign was. I thought, well, probably sitting at somebody's kitchen table, stuffing envelopes, maybe. I had no idea.
You wish.
Yeah. And, I've lived in Shasta County for 100 years, and I knew a lot of people. So I was taking him around and introducing him to people. And neither one of us at the time actually knew what a campaign entailed. We were just out meeting people and
colonizing.
What do you do, and what is your problem with government? And, oh, we got to fix that. We got to fix this. We got to fix that. And so that was in March of 2002. I think Sam was in preschool.
And we learned yesterday he ran for office 24 times and never lost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, if someone would ask me how many times did he run, but we got a lot of information yesterday. It was extraordinarily informational. Had an amazing cast of characters that spoke, including, and had Microsoft not conspired against me this morning, I really wanted to get the clip of his sixth grade teacher who spoke at the funeral, which was just super fun. Ooh, Doug got in trouble when he was in sixth grade. Threw a rock at a fan. He and another kid, there was a huge, huge, huge fan in the back of the school. And the teacher heard these weird noises and goes out there, and Doug and this other kid are whipping rocks at the fan to see if they'd shoot back at him. Which is really why Doug had so little opposition in campaign, because there was never any, he had no weird, ooh, hope that doesn't get out, you know. And all the only stuff they did, like, remember Jim Reed in that debate in Chico, said that Doug sold his water. Doug sold his water. I thought his mom was going to leap out of her chair and run up and strangle him. And afterward, a family friend, actually, who worked for the DA's office at the time, I think, she got up and, I mean, got right in his face, like up in Reed's face, and said, "They have never sold their water. What are you saying that for?" And he actually said out loud, he said, "Well, you have to understand, if I'm ever going to beat him, I am going to have to lie about him."
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. And I was like, wow.
Yeah.
Put that one in the memory bank.
Yeah. There was a, when I was a field rep, I was not there on my field rep duties. I was just having fun. I went to the Red Bluff chili feed, and there was a candidate for Congress who was running against Doug, who was sort of wandering around like the guys in the movies that say the world's ending, right?
Oh yeah, yeah.
And he was just yelling, you know, "Doug LaMalfa, like, he's never anywhere, nobody ever sees him, but I'm here in your community." So I always had my work phone on me, right? Always. And I downloaded the calendar, and I pulled up the calendar, and I stood next to him. I followed him around for an hour. And I was like, "Well, actually, Congressman LaMalfa is here and here and here." And at the time, it was unfortunate, but it was the perfect thing. He was at a funeral for a firefighter. And so he was wandering around telling everybody, you know, "Congressman LaMalfa is not in your community, and I am." And then I'd be, "Well, he's at this funeral for the firefighter, and then he's going to go to the Dairyville thing, and then he's going to go to this." And I followed him, just out of spite, I followed him around for like an hour and a half. And he more or less told me the same thing. He was like, "Listen, like, you know, I need to be more in touch with the community than Doug." And I was like, "That's really, like,
it's super not happening."
I was like, you're super not doing that.
I remember Patrick Jones told me one time, he goes, "You know, every time I go to some little kid's birthday party, I look in the backyard to see if Doug's back there."
Yeah. And the next week, you know, I would go to the Tama County Board of Supervisors meetings for Doug. Doug had me go to those almost every week. And this gentleman went to the Board of Supervisors, and he was, you know, "Doug LaMalfa isn't in your community. He's not here. He doesn't care about you." And so he got done speaking, and the board, some of which agreed with me, some of which did not agree with me on things, said, "You know, we'd like to recognize Sam Dorsey from Congressman LaMalfa's office for being so consistently around helping us with our problems." And that really, you know, like, if he couldn't be there, he made sure somebody else was there.
Exactly.
And for things that, you know, my friends would be like, why are you driving to this thing in the middle of the night? Why are you going to this, you know, three-person meeting?" I was like, "Well, because
that's what we do.
That's what we do. That's our job."
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, if we just showed up, can you imagine? You just show up when there's like a big thing and there's media or whatever.
Yeah, doesn't look good.
But that isn't real.
Yeah.
I mean, that isn't where you meet anybody, for one, because everybody's trapped in a chair. You meet people when you go to stuff where you hang out with people. But I always called it colonizing. You know, you go to some new place, there'd be, you know, people you didn't know, and you go, so did we pull into some wayward town. So let's see, for me, I covered Siskiyou, Modoc, and Lassen counties. We should talk about that a little too. So in the field side. And so we'd go to some far-flung place, and Doug's like, do we know these people? Have we colonized this area yet? So I'm like, oh yeah, we've colonized here, but we can do better. It was always pretty funny. And Brenda, you did mostly Shasta.
Shasta, yeah. Well,
and Tehama.
About that, everybody was important to him.
Yes.
Every person. And one example of that was back in the assembly days, one of the first meetings we had was we were coming out of the meeting and walking across a dirt parking lot, and Doug was driving a nice Mustang at the time, and there was a kind of a beat-up car sitting next to our car, and a man got out of the car. I was watching him. He stuck his hand out.
Because we're suspicious.
Yes.
Okay, but just be clear.
He stuck his hand out to shake Doug's hand, and he said, is this your car? And they started talking cars and motors and speed and all that. And after a few minutes, the man said, well, I'm sure you have more important people to go talk to. And Doug looked at him and said, I'll never forget it. He said, no, there's really nobody more important than you. And just looked at him like, you know, do you have anything else to say? And I thought, oh, my gosh, what an honor to work for a man like that.
Yeah. And that was the part that the people who didn't, you could always tell, I think we could all say the same thing. Anybody who called the office who said, oh, he's just some millionaire, you know, what? It's like, okay, he's still wearing this. Well, he is still wearing, probably currently, the same boots he was wearing when I met him 15 years ago. And he lives in a manufactured home on a dirt road on a farm. Like, never... you know,
we
he had a lot of ties, though. Oh. Apparently, some of them he took from Sam. I've learned that he was a tie thief, actually.
So, yeah, they were like, "Hey, can you? You know, you've been with him for a long time." It was me and the scheduler have been back in D.C. and they were like, "Let's go through his closet, make sure you know everything's okay." Because the closet was sort of it had sort of looked like a bomb had gone off. So we
like his car,
yeah,
it looked like a recycling center.
It looked like, and we needed to make sure there wasn't food in there. Like,
oh,
we didn't know
yes.
what was going on in there. So we were cleaning it out, and yeah, like
tacos in the pockets.
I have nicer. Yeah. I thought it was really funny because I was like, you know, I'm 29 and I have nice, many nicer suits than my congressman.
How many did he have? Two.
Yeah,
three.
Yeah, three, yeah. and some sort of like swap out. You know, you got them at Ross. you know, but
yeah.
he had this mountain of ties. And I'm going through it because they're literally falling out. Like, they're falling on the floor, so I'm having to, like, stuff them back into the floor or under the hooks. And I pick one of them up and I go, wait a minute.
This is mine.
That I've been looking for like 4 months. And, you know, I get, you know, when you're disorganized, you just sort of,
yeah,
like,
sure, things accumulate.
But, yeah, when we're sort of related to the everybody's important. So a while ago, one of my mentors in college, a very far left professor, came to visit me, and
because we both went to Humboldt State,
yes,
so we know what happens over there.
Yes.
Okay. Go on.
yeah. So this, and I told him, I was like, hey, you know, we got kind of a lefty, you know, and he is just infinitely warm to her, and he takes her into the Republican Club. Like the secret, you know, the and he takes there and he has dinner with her and me, during, you know, a pretty high stakes vote. And, he's just hanging out with her. And, you know, sort of the more professional staff, from other offices are like, you're letting this woman in here. Like, she's spying on us. And he's just hanging out with her, and she, you know, she's a professor of religion. And so he's sort of leaned back in his chair, and they kept talking about it at the funeral. The Doug, where he leans back and
yeah,
he sort of looks
down. Yeah, gives
down,
you the look.
And he goes, yo, teach. You're a religious professor, right? And she was like, yeah. And he's like, what's the best one? And she's like, what do you mean the best one? And he goes, what's the best religion? And
way to cut through the wheat.
Yeah. And he just had fun with sort of whoever he was plopped down with. And she was kind of afraid of him because he's a Republican congressman and she's a far left college, you know, coastal elite. And they, I don't know, she had a good time. Just made everybody that hung out with him just like hang out with him.
Yeah.
And that's how he was.
So, Alex said he has Mark's clip up. So Mark is our chief of staff. And he had the, I don't know, enviable, unenviable task, I guess, depending on how you look at it, of doing the eulogy for all of us on our behalf, basically, at the memorial yesterday. And
I might not have the right clip. I'll play it for you.
Isn't the one I'd have from 109?
Yeah, we'll see. Hopefully, if not, we'll find the right clip.
Okay.
Here we go.
Were regularly sprinkled into conversation. He'd work them into anything. His favorite project to criticize, high-cost rail. Besides bringing back the term boondoggle, he would regularly make fun of the price tag, and in true Dr. Evil fashion, $100 billion.
That was the right clip?
Yep.
Right, excellent.
Yeah, with the little finger up from Dr. Evil in Austin Powers, because, you know, everything related to some funny movie or The Godfather or something like that. But the part that was fun for all of us is that Governor Newsom was sitting in the front row while the high-cost rail was being basically mocked and
exposed,
and people were all laughing, actually. So he was in a very small bubble. Any chance we have David Reed's clip cued?
Not yet, but I'm working on it.
Okay,
so I have McCarthy.
So he. Oh, which one do we have? Okay, which one do we have for him?
Yeah, I can play it now.
Do it.
If you knew Doug, I know you did. I knew him his entire political career. And Doug taught me so many lessons. He wouldn't preach to you, he'd show you. And I called them Dougisms. And that's what I want to share with you today. The things he taught me. He taught me how to be a friend. We were in the minority, but we had fun, Sacramento. He was smart politically. In Sacramento, they used to give you a car. You'd drive up and drive back. And Doug wouldn't get a car. He just wouldn't get a car. I said, what are you doing? You got to drive around. He waited. The stories came out of everybody got a car. Then he got his. And he didn't just get any car. He got a Ford Mustang. And he would zip into that Capitol. And he had the best parking spot. But you have to understand, when you're a Republican in Sacramento, your car is parked three in. You got to ask two people to move before you can get yours out. But Doug came in and he had the parking spot right there. I just couldn't figure that out. I go to the parking attendant. I think I'm nice. I talk to him all the time. I said, how does Doug get that parking spot? I'm the leader. I said, old Mr. LaMalfa, he brings us all those peaches in the pickup truck every year.
Don't laugh silently. They can't see you. You have to laugh out loud in here.
Those peaches in the back of that little red Ford truck.
No, speak straight in because your voice is really quiet. Yeah, move it.
The peaches in that little red truck. Much he better. Came into the district office one day and he said, hey, Bren, you want some peaches? And I said, well, sure, that sounds great. So we stepped outside, and here in the back of that little red truck were peaches, just not in a box and not in bags. They were just rolling around in the bed of that truck. And he had been on curvy roads and accelerate and brake and whatever. And those poor little peaches, many of them were kind of bruised up a bit. But I took a whole bunch of those peaches home, and I came back the next day. I made a peach pie, and that was my way of thanking him for all those peaches.
This is really quick, but related to that, bringing fruit to people. He flew back every week, back and forth, and when it was the right season, he would stop at usually Burleson's or one of the on Highway 99, one of the fruit stands, or Julie's, and he would pick a huge bag or two of oranges and he would bring them, and he would take them as his carry-on to D.C. to give to all of us in the D.C. office. And so he would come in with just a lug of oranges in a backpack. And the oranges were not for him. He would just plop them on the table and leave. And, you know, you kind of think about it. This is a guy who's spending his own money and spending a carry-on slot to drag oranges back for his staff. you know, he was the kind of guy that would do that.
It's no wonder we had such a back mouse problem in the DC.
Yeah, yeah, it's, oh, my God. So, how about the tacos? It's tacos and Red Bluff.
Yeah.
He hated waste. Hated waste. Anyone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hated waste. We go to this town hall. No, it wasn't a town hall. Maybe it was a town hall. Anyway, it was in Red Bluff at the Veterans Memorial Building. A lot of people. So, one of our staff, Jennifer Horn, who was really a germaphobe, we'll just out her here, since she's not here, so, she was really very germ conscious. And she had bought a bag of tacos at Taco Bell, because Doug said, well, hurry up, go to Taco Bell, get some snacks, because there's no food, you know. So, these tacos were probably 60 cents a piece. I mean, this wasn't anything fancy, right? So there were a couple left in the sack, and they're like, you have to sit down. It's time to start. Doug's got to speak, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, Jennifer throws the sack in the garbage, but Doug doesn't see it. This thing goes on for three and a half hours after you talk to everybody and put away the chairs and do all the stuff. We're getting ready to leave. And Doug's like, didn't we have a couple tacos left? And everybody's like, yeah. He goes, well, where are they? And Jennifer goes, I threw them away. And he's like, no. Can't throw them away. What do you mean threw them away? She goes, I threw them away. You can't have them. It's been 3.5 hours. You'll get botulism. And he's like, all right, which can did you throw them in?
Oh, no.
The good news is he did not find them. But she was horrified. She's like, I'm not telling you. But it became a thing. So after that, every time we went to a deal and Jennifer was there, he's like, you wasted two tacos. It's like, here's the $1.20. Yeah. I don't know. It's just funny. He just hated the idea of waste.
He hated waste and
government or personal.
Your rite of initiation in D.C. was, you know, was, he would just tell you, go get the meats. And you would, I didn't know what that meant the first time he texted it to me. But pretty much everybody, when you first come to D.C., your job is to go get the meats. And what the meats are is he goes to a couple breakfasts. And they just throw away the food when everybody's done.
Oh, whoops.
And he could not stand that.
Yeah.
So he himself was doing it, but if he had to go somewhere, which he was pretty busy, so yeah. Actually we'd go somewhere, he would send staff after him to go and get everything that otherwise would get thrown out and bring back for the rest of the staff. He did that. He went to the prayer breakfast. He went to a couple briefing breakfasts. Pretty much anything he went to where he found out they were throwing away food. He was known on the Hill for his pocket sandwiches because he would just sort of show up mostly to the younger staff who, you know, and he would just like pull out like an Egg McMuffin and just be like, hey, do you want this? And the problem was, is, you know, it would be like 3 o'clock and you'd be like, well, how long have you had this Egg McMuffin? Everybody at the funeral said he wouldn't take no for an answer, and he super wouldn't take no for an answer with his like weird pocket sandwiches. And we, you know, people would throw them away, and then you had to hide it from them. You couldn't let him know that you threw away the pocket sandwich, because he'd go into this whole, you know, like a farmer, like spent all of his time on the eggs and the wheat and the meat, and an animal died for you, and so everybody sort of, whether they ate him or not, was like, yes, thank you, sir. Like, it was great. But he, yeah, I mean, he probably, he fed all of us all the time with just, like, random bacon and pocket sandwiches.
He would tell the staff to go get the meats.
Go get the meats.
Oh, my God.
You learned strategic garbage disposal very quickly in that office if you didn't want to get caught wasting food.
Yeah, there was he catered something once, and we had a bunch of cannoli in the refrigerator. We couldn't eat it all. It was trays of cannoli.
Really?
Yeah, so it was weeks. It was weeks of old cannoli. And he wouldn't let us throw it away. We'd go to do it, and he'd be like, that's perfectly good. So we had to wait until he would go home for a couple weeks, and then we'd throw it away.
It's kind of funny. I got him a magnet up at the Aiden store. They have all that, you know, eclectic stuff up there at the Aiden store. And I found this magnet, and it was like a 1950s mom, like a Leave It to Beaver's mom, with the little apron on and her daughter, and, you know, they superimpose writing above it. And the little girl is looking up at her mom, and there's a refrigerator there, and she looked at her, and she's and it says, "It's fine, honey. Expiration dates are for the week."
That was really his attitude.
And I was like, oh, it's Doug. I got to get him this.
Yeah.
Perfect.
It was pretty funny. I do believe that's what he thought. So I have another one queued up that we can our brakes are all screwed up today. Everything is screwed up today. You know what I mean? Everything's just off. So thanks for riding with us on Screwed Up Off Day. But so David Reed was Doug's original chief of staff in the assembly. And he spoke at one point, but since he lives in Texas, he had a little more leeway than maybe some of the folks who were on the speaking list. And the governor was sitting right in the front row, and so there was some fun. Like, you wouldn't think it like a memorial for someone that everybody was really going to miss, that there would be any fun, but there was some fun. So it was like you cried, you laughed. There was a whole range of things, but we pulled this one for you. So here's David Reed.
Doug took me to get my first pair of cowboy boots, which I wear today at Diamond W in Chico, to meet his friend David Halimi. And I always got on him to trim that big old Grizzly Adams beard. Doug is one of my closest friends. You know, I believe politics is one of the ultimate crucibles for human beings. It really is an endeavor that boils people down to who they truly are and reveals their true character to others. And within that crucible, Doug revealed himself always to be a very good man. Along with that childlike joy he always possessed, he was very comfortable as a leader. Unafraid of speaking out where others were timid, he was always courageous. And even in the face of a grotesque racial gerrymander perpetrated here in California by unscrupulous politicians, Doug LaMalfa was undaunted. And even on that last evening, I was able to spend with Doug in Washington, December 3rd. He was ready. He was enthusiastic for the campaign ahead. And I am certain that Doug would have once again defied his critics and been victorious in this campaign. You know, it's said that people may not remember what you said, but they'll always remember how you made them feel. And Doug LaMalfa always made people feel good and feel important. That was his superpower. Doug's genuine interest in other people, his inspired ability to notice and recall our names, our stories, and significant events in our lives. This superpower enabled Doug to forge meaningful relationships with literally thousands of people during a very consequential and all too brief life. No, our friend Doug was not a typical politician. He was a servant of his Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Called to serve in this very noble calling of public life, where he would lead us, inspire us, and model for us all how we too can live more meaningful lives in service to one another. indeed, Doug LaMalfa was a great man. Because he was a good man. And most of all, he was my friend. Rest well, brother man, until we meet again. Thank you.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Dead Love is Johnny Cash. Actually, Ring of Fire was his ringtone for 1,000 years. Remember that?
Yes, yes. Can I tell a story real fast?
Do it.
There was, I think it was 2008, a really big fire, bad fire year. And the Anderson Fairgrounds, Shasta District Fairgrounds in Anderson, was a big fire city. All the agencies and everybody was set up down there as the command headquarters. And Doug and I walked in to a tent full of all these important fire people. And just as he walked in the door, they were in the process of the meeting because we were traditionally a couple of minutes late. We come walking in the door. His phone goes off.
Please ring of fire.
And it was, I fell
into a burning
ring of fire. And the crowd erupted. So he just stood there like, hello.
I'm here.
Nothing like having the perfect ringtone, right?
Yeah.
So Laura pointed out that we had just in our little quickie overview of security, Butte County Sheriff. I didn't bring the program. What a great idea. Here, you've got the program. Read on.
Oh, and also Unified North State Honor Guard brought in the colors.
They did an amazing job.
They did a very good job.
And the bagpipes, yes. Of course, so that we could cry extra.
Yeah, they really had to end things with Amazing Grace. Like you know.
At least they didn't do taps.
Oh, yeah.
I was kind of sad they didn't do taps, but I was like, I'm like dehydrated.
That was the thing. I kind of collected myself by the end, and then they were like, oh, now we're going to all play Amazing Grace and the bagpipes. And I was like, great, cool.
Yeah.
I had,
one more cry.
Yeah, I had fallen so to pieces. The guy in front of me was... It was
Tim Moore.
Yeah, Tim Moore. Congressman Tim Moore like grabbed me and was like, "Oh!" And I was like, "This is what an experience."
Oh my gosh! So I told you, everybody thinks, "Oh, 2 hours. It's going to take. How are we going to have so much? We're not going to have time. We're almost jacked up against the news." So I don't know what Alex has in mind for us. We're trying to read each other's minds from two different rooms. Oh, I got a thumbs up. So we have to take a break. I just want to point out again that this is just kind of a little impromptu staff gathering post memorial for Congressman Doug LaMalfa. And we've listed a whole bunch of things on the webpage for today that would get you to viewing things that are I think you would really like, actually, and you would get to know him a little better. And you would stop saying that all politicians are horrible. It's good to know that there are good people who do run, who do get elected, and do serve for a long time. You can find it at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Good afternoon, and welcome to the second half of We the People Radio. It is January 25th, 2026, and I'm still Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Still Bill.
Still Bill.
A.K.A.
Willis.
Willis. So we're talking about our friend and our boss and our representative, Congressman Doug LaMalfa, the day after his memorial down in Chico. And so we have a group of staff here. Couple of our guys from D.C. So we have George.
Hello.
George's nickname was?
Jungle and Junkie George, depending on Chief's mood.
Depending on whether he's in trouble or not.
Yes.
And we have?
Sam the Sham, parentheses. And the Pharaohs.
Because you didn't know who they were.
I didn't know who they were, but he knew I liked sort of older music. And so that was how I got that name.
I remember when you were like, who's Sam the Sham?
And I was like, what's this guy talking about?
How old am I, right? And we have Brenda Haynes.
Bun Bun.
A.K.A. Bun Bun. And we have Laura Burnett.
Landslide Laura.
Little Landslide Laura. Won her election by 3 votes. Which made the landslide part just even funnier.
Yeah.
Doug just had a funny idea, you know.
Yeah.
I was Dan Newhouse, he always called him Lieutenant Dan.
Lieutenant Dan.
I can't tell you how many times I was in the car and he'd be like, "Hey, it's Newhouse." And he'd be like, "Lieutenant Dan." Like, he's the accent. You know, we need to answer. Who were some of the other ones?
Oh.
But the Hawaii.
Oh, the Hawaii lay. Takuda. Her name was Barracuda.
Barracuda. Mr. Potato Head.
Her name was Fedorchak.
Yes, Fedorchak was Woodchuck.
And no, but he would say, how much wood does a Fedorchak chuck if a Fedorchak would chuck wood?
Yeah.
She's like, I'll never hear that again.
Yeah, and the gal in the tunnel we were talking about earlier, she had a nickname. Everybody had a nickname.
She worked at the information desk in the tunnel.
Yes, in the tunnel. She had a nickname. I don't know her nickname, but all the floor staff had a nickname. And sometimes it was a rhyme, sometimes it was something real.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, everybody he came in contact with had a nickname, and for us in the DC office, you would have to call people by their nicknames. So you know, you'd be like, Congressman Newhouse wants to, and he'd be like, who? And you'd go, Congressman Newhouse, and you go, who's that? And then you get the what he was doing, and you'd be like, Lieutenant Dan wants to write a letter. And it was disarming because, you know, D.C., there's lots of people that are sort of buttoned up and very serious. And
full of themselves.
Full of themselves.
Yes.
And you can't be full of yourselves when a sitting congressman is telling you.
Lieutenant Dan.
And showing you David Bowie music videos. Like, that's
right.
You can't do that. So.
Yeah. Oh, and Fong. Vince Fong. He was the Fongressman.
Yeah. Fongressman.
Fongressman.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. There were like a million of them.
Yeah.
But they were funny. Like, a lot of times when people get like a nickname, it's an inside joke. This was just like kind of a term of endearment, and it was an outside term of endearment.
Yeah.
Like everyone. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a lobbyist I did a lot of work with. She was in and out of the office. We were trying to secure the rural schools. She had really sort of like bright red hair, and she just became the redhead. That was her. He'd be like, "Hey, is the redhead with you?" My wife was the old lady because she's younger than me and about 5'2". And he thought that was really funny.
She was the old lady.
The old lady. How's your old lady? And then she would come in and visit, and he'd be like, "Ah, it's the old lady." So, you know, it's my tiny little 5'2" wife. He didn't change the names.
No.
Yeah.
It wasn't transitory, liked you, didn't like you kind of stuff. There was somebody who was named EP.
Yes.
That I will not out. But it was pretty funny. Like, sometimes it was initials, sometimes it was a descriptor, but it just kind of made things more fun, actually.
Yep.
Kevin McCarthy. So back when we were having the whole drama with the Speaker of the House stuff, and people really did not, they were mad at Doug for supporting Kevin McCarthy. Remember that whole thing? How could we ever forget? Ew. And Matt Gaetz, the pig, is now gone. Yay. Just for the record, I always knew he was bad. I used to tell Doug, he's horrible. And Doug's like, no, he's nice, because Doug was way nicer than all of us, which we spent 2.5 hours talking about yesterday in public, right? Doug was always nicer than we were. And I said, no, he's horrible. And he's like, why do you say that? And I'm like, well, because you know what? I think ultimately he's going to screw us. And I think he's a bad guy. So something would happen, and you know, 6 months goes by. We'd be on the phone. Doug's like, so, you still hate Matt Gaetz? And I'm like, oh, yeah, all day, every day, twice on Sunday. And so this was like a running joke, right? Hey, how's Matt Gaetz? I'm like, nope, still not on the team, not on the team. And then Matt Gaetz flips his good friend of many, many years, Kevin McCarthy, out of his seat. And I'd like to tell you I'm a bigger person than this, but I'm so not. And the first time we spoke after that, I'm like, so, how about Matt Gaetz? Are we ready to revisit that yet? And he's like, yeah, you were right. You were right. And I'm like, mm-hmm, you should listen to me more. So we have some clips of Kevin McCarthy because his commentary was really quite good. And I thought, just in the quick stuff I could do this morning, we were able to see a little bit of the inside, you know, back relationship that they had from the assembly days in the state. So how about the car? The car was, oh, wait, you already played the car. I already played the part about the car with the peaches in the parking lot. The Biden one, the State of the Union. A lot of times people saw Doug sitting on the aisle at the State of the Union. And those of us who worked for him know he never got anywhere early, ever. Did he ever get anywhere early in D.C.? Yeah, no, okay. No. It was the same here and there, bi-coastal lateness. But he would arrive hours and hours and hours before a major thing like that, State of the Union or something, and sit on the aisle so that he could have a few seconds with whoever the person was, whether it was the president or Benjamin Netanyahu or somebody who was speaking on the House floor at a special speech. And McCarthy had a little back information for that.
I remember when I was speaker, when the first State of the Union, Joe Biden gave this State of the Union. And when it was over, he didn't want to leave. He wanted to greet everybody. And you got to understand, the Republicans all leave. And it was the Democrats sitting there, and like others, they want to take pictures. And I look over and I see Doug. I'm up in the rock. I'm trying to get his eye. Why are you waiting? You know, I have to. You don't. You know? You can leave, right? And I've seen people take pictures. Oh, please don't take a picture or selfie like that. He didn't. You know why he stayed? Because of you. He wanted to talk to the president about the forestry and the fires and the water in his district. He never once pulled his phone out. You know what Joe Biden did? He admired that. It made a difference. And he would sacrifice his own reputation because of you. He was always there for you.
Yep. And so people would ask, like, and then there were times when he would wait for, like, President Trump, and then he, like, he could see them whispering, and my phone would blow. Did you guys have that, too?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, your text messages would explode, and everybody's like, what's he doing? What did he say? What did they do? I'm like, it just happened. I'm watching it on TV, same as you. What do you think? But that was always something to watch for, and I think people really... But then people really like that. You know, 535 members of Congress, and like, hey, we know that guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he always, I mean, a big part of what he did was, I mean, pretty much every time it was wildfires and water, and we got to do something for our people. And that's what I heard from him after every State of the Union is what he talked about. But people would come unglued. They'd be like, "What? How dare you talk to Joe Biden?"
Right, right. What was he doing? Yeah. I'm like, oh, he's switching teams. Okay, no, he wasn't. What do you think he was doing?
Yeah. It's always amazing that the people here in our neck of the woods would make a judgment about what they saw on TV. Like, how dare him talk to Biden? Well, I understood that after he did talk to Biden about water and timber, that Biden did send over somebody to talk with him.
Yeah,
did
the White House sent people to go talk to us, which, I mean, how it works in D.C. is almost always, if your party is not the president's party, the president is not sending White House legislative people to go talk to you about your problems. That's just, you know, you're locked out. So that was highly irregular. But
in true Doug fashion, it worked.
It worked. It worked, and some good things came out of that. And at the very worst case scenario, at least some people had to hear about the problems that we have up here, and they had to sit with that and think about what they were doing to us. And that was the very worst case scenario. Best case scenario is we got some things moved around.
Yeah, and that's why he was there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people kind of lose sight of sometimes, I think, is he's there speaking for us.
But they wanted
never missed an opportunity.
Yeah, he wanted to be. They wanted him to be like a flame-throwing, right winger and give fiery speeches and denigrate everybody. And they didn't understand why he didn't do that. But that doesn't actually work. And his way was a lot better.
Yeah, like that way leads to ad revenue. It does not lead to representing your district super well. And he was no less right than anybody else that they wanted him to be like.
Well, it's kind of funny because Kevin McCarthy talked about that a little bit, and here's a little insight on that.
And he exemplified that. You know, in Washington, we put food in the back to try to get you to come, because members aren't wealthy, kind of live away, and they're just trying to get the food. And it seemed like every time I'd see Doug in the back at the inn loading up his plate again. Doug, we got to cut back. He said, no, it's not for me. He was going to the cloakroom to feed the staff because they were staying late too. And he knew them all by name, and they had the nicknames. They called him Chief. But when I said everyone matters, the reputation he had, if there was two people meeting, Doug was there. That's how we knew he would win. And he would take the opportunity to work with the other side. It's a testament to who's here. Because I'll promise you, I don't think some of them are coming to my funeral.
That was the pinnacle of levity at that point. I think that was the most we laughed, and I think it caught everybody off guard, actually.
It did.
But it was super true.
Yeah. And when he said it, he sort of panned his face to Gavin Newsom, you know, across that section of the audience.
Oh yeah. And Bill and I were sitting back and about three seats to the right of Jared Huffman, and I immediately looked at him, and he had like a huge kind of smile on his face, like, true story. A confirming smile, we'll call it.
And I handled natural resources, energy, and all that stuff for Doug, which, you know, we sparred with Mr. Huffman a lot, and I thought it was really funny, and Doug would have thought it was funny that I walked into the funeral right next to Jared Huffman, who we had fought against for the whole time I've been in D.C.
forever, and who he had just his last I'll find that. But his last time on the floor, they had a battle. I'll find that, and we'll play that a little bit later. But he really felt like Mr. Huffman was going to ultimately, if Prop 50 was upheld, kidnap his constituents.
And he
was not happy about it. And yet Huffman did make the effort to come all the way out. All the way over.
And credit where credit's due. Like on the floor, when they had an hour for him, for members to talk about him, Mr. Huffman gave one of the better eulogies for him.
Yes, he did.
He's been 20 years back and forth with Doug, and you know they were arch nemesises. But I think he still understood what a big man Doug was.
Yeah.
Well said.
Yeah, it's interesting how that translates, because from what we've said, you would think, oh, well, Doug was a moderate, right? Because that's the way these things are cast these days. So, yeah, Doug got along with everybody. Everyone liked him. He was a moderate. But Doug was absolutely not a moderate, and his voting record was in the top, what, 3, 5?
Yeah.
Conservative voters in the House?
Yeah.
The whole House?
Well, what did Trump? Trump said, we never have to call him.
Voted with Trump 100% of the time.
Yeah, and I mean, he on social policy, he was sort of a heavyweight because he was the first guy to introduce, you know, sort of the flagship bills on gender transition, banning that, and things to protect kids from sort of the excesses of what's going on in California. And it's some guy from California, but it makes sense. You know, it's a guy from California who's listening to people in his district who are having to deal with the things inflicted on them by the state government. So we got it way before everywhere else did, way before this stuff became sort of national conversation. So, you know, he in D.C., people respected that he was sort of the first of the fire on a lot of these things. But, he, you know, he wasn't going on the news screaming about it. So a lot of people just sort of didn't know that.
Isn't that funny? And so not being and so being the press guy, George. Mm-hmm. When you were the press guy, how?
Oh, I had fun when it came to the gender stuff. In his fact, his favorite floor speech while I was there was one that I wrote for him, where I intentionally called that like his real name is William Thomas, but he on the news you might know him as Leah Thomas. He's some like 6 foot dude who's.
Right.
A swimmer who like tries to swim with girls because that's
right.
Just what they do over there, I guess. But I made sure to have him on at least 3 occasions during that 1 minute floor speech call him out by his name, William Thomas, and Twitter blew up for about 4 hours where all these lefties and all these trannies and whatnot are, oh my God, he's so mean, I can't believe he said that. And Chief comes back afterwards and he's like, huh. Think it made a man? Yes, sir. That's what you pay me for.
So you were.
Oh, when he let me throw fire, I got my flamethrower out.
Yeah, but which George were you? You were Jungle George.
That was a Jungle George.
That was a Jungle George moment.
That was.
Okay, so I found the clip on the wolf. So the preceding part of this, and were you there during this one?
I had the privilege and honor to be there.
Okay, please set it up for us, because what did Huffman say?
So basically, Mr. Huffman and his cabal of associates were on the other side, basically saying, they kept referencing Little Red Riding Hood, and how, you know, these wolves are not a big deal, and these are just, you know, ranchers and big business want to kill all the wolves so they can drill for oil, and they don't care about the environment. Yeah, there's this oil narrative that makes no sense. Anyway, there's just, you can go and look at it. They're basically saying, oh, your people are
hysterical
up
stories.
This is hysterical nonsense, and it's not real, and you just want to kill the environment and strip all the protections away from every single thing, and, you know, it's a big giveaway to big oil, and
that's really, I didn't know that. That's a very weird connection. That makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, you know, they're not sending their best.
All that being said, and then Doug said,
very much my colleague from Arkansas. You know, it's amazing here. I represent the northeast corner of California where the wolves are being inflicted upon the people and the wildlife of that area. And the stuff I hear coming from the other side of the aisle about recovering the wolves and even the mocking. Yes, it's real. There's wolves that are encroaching on elementary schools in Siskiyou County, the Little Shasta Elementary School. This isn't some Little Red Riding Hood story. This isn't some made-up deal. It's very real. And they're coming closer and closer to town all over the northeast part of California. So my colleague from the North Coast, when he mocks us like that, I'm wondering, if this Proposition 50 in California kicks in, and he ends up representing my constituents up there that are fighting against this, and I'm their only voice in that echo chamber of California against this, are you going to have town halls up there? Are you going to go into Modoc County, Siskiyou County, Sierra Valley, and tell them this is a Red Riding Hood story about the wolves devouring their livestock, eating up all their wildlife? You know, it's the mocking. Why is it you
can't
stand?
The gentleman will suspend. The House will be in order. Gentlemen may continue.
That was Huffman.
Why is it you
out?
Can't stand the people that produce the food, the lumber that come from my part of the state, from the West, from the rural parts of America? Is it you want all of your beef? If you don't eat beef, you might be able to have this conversation. Do you want your beef to be imported from somewhere else? You don't want it not to be produced here under our standards? Why is it you hate my constituents that just try and provide the urban people with what they need? Because we don't need a hell of a lot that's coming from the urban area, I'll tell you what. So if you want to cater only to Marin County and have this population continue to devastate our people up there and rein in just a little bit the misinterpretation of the Endangered Species Act over the 50 years, yeah, it was well-intentioned when it came out. It was a temporary tool, but it never was meant to be a life or even a death sentence for livestock and for people's livelihoods in this area of here or all over the West.
The devil went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, "Boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now, you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul, because I think I'm better than you."
Good sense, ill sense, crippling mankind. Dead kings, many things I can't define. Old Cajuns, fives, wagons, clutter your mind. In the sense of temperaments, the color of time.
Who cares what games we choose?
Doug and the Music. Okay, so the youngsters in the room, because Bill and Laura and Brenda and I, we know all the music, but you guys, how foreign was it?
He would always, this. We had to explain this once a week. We have government computers with bad speakers, and he would always be like, pull up this song.
You have what?
We have government computers.
Oh, government, yeah.
You know, in D.C., and they have really bad speakers because the government's not trying to get you to, like, listen to music on your computer.
There's no stereo.
Yeah, there's no. Yeah. And he would always be like, "Hey, like, pull up this song," or he'd reference something, people wouldn't get it, and then he'd be like, "Well, now we need to show it." He would stop meetings. He would be late to things. He would be late to committee. He would skip out of committee for a second just to, And one of the last things is, and this was actually, it was kind of weird. On my way here, I was like, what are we gonna think about with Doug? What are we gonna talk about with Doug? Every week, you know, when he came in, he'd say, "Hey, kids," and then he'd kind of greet everybody. When he would come to my desk, he would sort of lean up against the desk, and he would look at me from sort of like the side, and he'd go, "Hey, man." And as I was driving here, David Bowie's Suffragette City came on, which he made me pull up for somebody once. But the chorus is, "Hey, man." And I thought, but that was he did that for everybody, staff, sometimes we would get mad at him. We'd be like, "Hey, we get it. Your boomer music, it's cool. But we gotta go to a hearing with the secretary right now." And he'd be like, "No, this is important."
Oh, my God. Yeah. It's funny how, because we were 10 months apart age-wise, so we listened to all the same songs and, you know, watched all the same movies, and I tend to remember stuff like that and reference things like that a lot. Like, you were kind of trained when you were at our office. How many times did I show you YouTube things?
Generally, the end of the day. See, you were smart enough. You scheduled at the end of the day, usually. You'd be like, "Hey,
Sam,
come in here.
I need to bring your knowledge base up so you can, you know, be current in the Wayback Machine."
Yeah. And I mean, like you said earlier, I went to Humboldt State, so psychedelic music, sort of some of that 60s stuff carried over. So I was the greatest inoculated against not knowing things. But,
sure.
He really pulled some obscure stuff out.
But then there was the not obscure that would catch the age, and I'll have to put that clip on here. So at one point we went on a field trip up to the dope grows that we have talked about extensively on this program. If you'd like to see photos of them, you could go to the pot tab at wethepeopleradio.us. Click on pot, and you can see all the pictures of what we went to see. And so I had finagled it so that we were there that day when they were doing a bunch of demolition on grows they had raided there. And I told one of the guys, I go, "Hey, see if you can get Doug to get, you know, drive one of the bulldozers so we could drive over some of the stuff." And he's like, "Oh, that'd be so cool." I go, "Oh, he'd be super excited." They're like, "Well, does he know how to run a D8? I'm all, "Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does. He's good." So he gets to drive over this greenhouse, and he just was having a field day. So he gets out, he comes out, whips the door open, and he wants to lay down the line. Anyone? Back to me. he does like a big breath in, and he says, "I love the smell of diesel in the afternoon. It smells like freedom." And of course, we're like all laughing and stuff. And that clip got put out in a, I don't know, like a, was it a press release or something? It got put on, you guys actually know?
Something. I mean, it kind of flew
before my time.
It flew everywhere.
So you didn't do it? That was before your time?
I had to hear the story from folks in the D.C. office, and this was like after, I guess, it had sparked lawsuits or something.
It turned into, it became controversial because it went out, and then I had someone who will remain nameless call me and say, "What the heck is wrong with that anyway? Why is everybody so upset about that?" And they said it's Asian hate. And I'm like, well, the people that are growing there are predominantly Asian, which has nothing to do with it. They're basically criminals, so, you know, nobody cares about that. However, might have been the line he used. Well, yeah, but that's a famous line. I go, "Do you know where it comes from?" No. This was the person who put it out, actually. And, and I'm like, that's a really super famous line from Apocalypse Now. She's seen it. The funny part was that was in real life, and it was like the face. No. I'm like, yeah, that's from Apocalypse Now. He goes, "Why didn't someone tell me?" I'm like, because everybody already knows, right? He goes, "No, I know the line, but I didn't know the movie." So every now and then, Doug's obscure references would cause blowback. That was,
yeah.
That went on for a while.
We,
the Apocalypse Now.
Yeah. It's still going on in some ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, we would have to argue with him about, he would use SpongeBob to explain things in committee.
Yes.
He'd be like, "Hey, you know, it'd be like that episode where like Squid," you know, he would like sort of play by play an episode.
This is just like Patrick Starr.
Yeah, to like try to explain a problem. And what's sad is usually he was right. It was a good way to explain. But explaining through via the instrument of SpongeBob in a congressional hearing or in a meeting with a secretary is a little like, oh.
Let's boil it down.
Yeah. You know, but I mean, it was super awesome to be in it, you know, these big scary meetings, these closed door meetings, and everybody's really serious. And then he would bring up SpongeBob and to look at people's faces.
God, that must have been awesome.
Like, is this really happening? Is this congressman using SpongeBob references in committee hearings?
He kept them all very humble.
Yes, yes. And Austin Powers, I mean.
Yeah, a lot of Austin Powers.
A lot of Austin Powers. Three Amigos.
Yeah.
Anything Mel Brooks made, really.
Star Trek?
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
Star Trek?
He got like a time when Kirk told Spock this and this and this.
He would get in arguments about Star Trek with actually the same gal who had the red hair. He had sort of gone back and forth over whether Next Generation versus the other, you know. And we were trying to get like $500 million of funding for something, and I was like, "Hey, I don't know that this is what we should be doing right now."
Did it work?
Yeah. We eventually got it. They, you know.
Ultimately, you got the.
Yeah, we eventually got it.
Got the money. So, so Speaker Johnson had some comments at the I don't know at what point I was going to say at the beginning. I can't remember. But he talked about how many times Doug spoke on the floor. And during the break, we were just like, "Oh, we can't forget to mention that." So, cue Speaker Johnson.
You all are in California, this beautiful land with this perfect weather, and we left Washington this morning about 5 a.m., and it was like 12 degrees, and with the wind chill, it was well below zero. At least it felt like that to me, a Louisiana kid. But there's a polar vortex you may be aware of going through the country right now, and about half the country is shut down. Most of our colleagues are grounded. But in spite of that, because it's Doug, I had to arrange to get Air Force Two to bring a plane full of members and staff out here to be a part of this. I mean, there's very few people who could muster that kind of crowd under these conditions, okay? But Doug did. The vice president gave us the plane. I had another one arranged, but we had a mechanical error. So this went all the way to the top, my friends, because it's Doug. Yeah. I want you to know how special Doug was to me. And I'm not the only one. Everybody has a story like this, a testimony like this, of what he did for them or how they felt about him. And I got to know him really well a few years back. I was serving before I became speaker. I was the vice chairman of the House Republican Conference. And the obscure job of that obscure title is that my weekly responsibility was basically to try to recruit members to come onto the House floor and fill the time there so that the Democrats wouldn't capture the time. And so that we could use that well, because the whole idea was we were trying to amplify the message of the House Republican caucus and get it out there for the C-SPAN viewers, you know, all 20 of them that were watching late at night. And then I would try to sell my colleagues every week so earnestly, you know, I was serving under Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and he'd go fill the floor time. I'm trying, Kevin, I'm trying. And I would say, come on, guys, it's great. It's everybody on C-SPAN's watching, and you know, and you can clip the video and put it on social media, you know? And then people will think a lot of folks saw it. And, you know, it'll help us get the message out. I mean, they basically gave me the same reaction that you did. And so I had to fill an hour every week. And so here's the long story short. Very few people participated in this activity, okay? But you know who signed up first every single week? Doug LaMoth. You know why? Because he showed up. And there was this one night that just resonates with me, and I'll never forget it. It was one night, I mean, literally, I had to fill an hour, okay? Doug is the only person who showed up. And it was a night we had canceled session the next morning, and so everybody just jetted to the airports. I had a few RSVPs, but they backed out, they dropped out. Well, Doug showed up. Now, remember, he had to fly all the way back home to California, but he put his name on that paper, and he wasn't going to leave me there by myself. And so Doug and I know. Doug and I stood there and filled an hour, the two of us. And everything he said was deeply meaningful and powerful and resonated. I mean, it's great. He was a great orator. I mean, and we finished and we were walking off the floor, and I put my arm around his big shoulder and I said, "Brother, I love you, but why? You didn't have to do this. Why did you do that?" And he got real serious. He gave me a dug, you know, and he got really serious and looked at me and he said, he said, "'Cause I believe in you. And, I'm not going to make you stand here and do this by yourself." And he said, "And I believe in this cause. And I believe in what we're doing here. And I believe in this great country. And I think we ought to take every opportunity available to us to stand on that House floor and tell the American people what we're doing for them."
Wow. Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
Yeah. I thought that was pretty telling. Very telling, actually. What do you think, Alex? Got music? He does. All right, we have to take a break. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'll soon be with you, my love. Make a new start. Going to California with an aching in my heart. Someone told me there's a girl out there with love in her eyes and flowers in her hair.
I thought we were going to just keep listening. We're running out of time. So we've got, I don't know, like 20 minutes left. So we're going to cram in all the other stuff we've done over all the years. But back to the Speaker Johnson clip you heard right before the break. Doug spoke a lot on the floor.
So Doug was often the number one speaker on the floor.
He number of 1 minute speeches, like
number of time on the floor.
There you go.
Over the course of his whole tenure, he had probably he hovered between 3 and 1 constantly. He won most. They have little competitions to like make sure that everybody wants to be on the floor, and he would always win. There's 1 year we boycotted. Because one guy owned like a newspaper and he was counting every time his speeches were in the newspaper, and Doug was like, we're not participating in that. But frequently,
poor George, he's like, He's always conspiring to screw you on the press side, wasn't he?
Yeah, that was the thing about doing press for Doug, is he didn't want to do it, and then when he did it, he was extremely particular. And he was like that on Capitol Hill, they have the prayer breakfast, and that's a closed door. It's a Bible study. Doug didn't brag about going to that. He didn't really even talk about it, but absolutely nothing could be scheduled.
And it was Thursdays.
Yes,
it wasn't
Thursday
once
morning.
A year.
No.
This was a
morning.
Regular appointment.
Thursday morning, he went every Thursday, and he had only, as far as I know, I'm not a scheduler, so I'm sure Savannah's scheduler will yell at me if I get this
no,
wrong.
No, she told me this.
But she told,
yes.
We could move around kind of anything. You could schedule anything, except nothing could touch the Bible study. And then after the Bible study, he would go to the Bible study. It was like an hour, and he wouldn't leave early. He would go every Thursday. And then afterwards, he would mark up everything, and he would take doubles, and he would bring one back for him. And then, I have a degree in religion, and he knew I was interested in that. And then he would give me his half for me to review.
Of whatever
the papers were, the scripture, their devotional. And then sometimes if he thought something was relevant to somebody in our staff, he would try to give it to them. That was the thing about him. He ultimately, he was all of our boss, but his real concern, especially in D.C., because we're all so much younger than him, was making sure that we got to heaven. After the Charlie Kirk shooting, the assassination, he pulled us all in the back office and he talked to us about a little bit about what happened, but ultimately I think what affected him is one of the only times I ever saw him tear up. And it wasn't about that really, it was about that any of us could go. And he sort of sat us all down and was like, you guys, you need to make sure that you're where you need to be in your faith. And he sort of shared the gospel with all of us. Some of us, or most of us, are already on the team in some form or another. But that's what he was really worried about. He didn't talk about going to church. He didn't talk about going to Bible study. I'm pretty sure he'd be mad about.
Oh yeah,
me.
That we outed him.
Yeah, I've outed him as a man of God. Because he didn't think that was the point of it, right?
Well, he wasn't shy about it, but he was never going to tell you that.
Yes.
All these people who tell, well, I'm a Christian, and that's like the first thing they say about everything. I'd never heard him, like. If someone asked him, he would tell them.
Yeah.
But that wasn't his disclaimer of who he was.
Yeah. People would always ask me, they were like, is Doug a Catholic or a Protestant? And I'd go, well, I don't really know. He's not getting denominational on it. He was very devout, and he would go to all the Bible studies. But he was always trying to make sure people were caring about what was most important.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, it's funny, and you think in Washington, D.C., everyone thinks that everybody goes there and changes. That's another point. I guess we didn't really make, but he never changed. And I mean, for my part of it, I cried when he got elected to Congress because all I could think of was, oh, no, now he's going to become all yucky like those guys. And he never, when I interviewed with him, I told him that, I said, well, I'll do this, but if you ever lie to me, or you ever ask me to lie for you, or I find that you've done something weird or creepy or wrong, I'm going to quit that day, and I'm going to get on the radio and anything else I have, and I'm tell everybody forever, and you'll never be able to make me stop. And he kind of started laughing. Well, he did start laughing, and it was like, huh, you're either laughing because you're not bad, or you think I'm kidding. And I thought, well, we'll roll the dice and see where it goes. And after 15 years, he was laughing because he knew I just didn't know him very well.
Yeah. And there were a couple things he changed his mind on over the course of Congress, and you know, votes or things, he'd flip-flop, was what he would get accused of. And people would go, how did you do this as his staffer? Like, what changed? And every single thing that he changed his mind on or direction on while I was working for him was somebody gave him more information. There wasn't some lobbyist. There wasn't some donation from somebody. He had a long conversation with usually me or somebody came in with the actual situation. And that was the thing. He wasn't fake. He didn't let anything get changed. He was always just trying to do what actually worked for our people. And that's really what would swing votes at the end of the day.
Like, have him change his mind.
Yeah. No amount of lobbying could have got him to swing. It was...
Well, I mean, he was extremely pro-life. And mm-hmm. So I remember at the office, I think we all got calls from, you know, the pro-choice groups who would say, well, I want to come and meet with him. And I'm like, hey, full disclosure, you could bring 500,000 people and camp out outside his farm, and he's not changing his mind.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't a thing where he's going to tally votes and make a decision. He was deeply, deeply convicted on that and many other things.
I've been around where some of the pro-life groups would give him awards, and they'd be like, oh, you scored 100, here you go. And he would always say, you know, like, well, like, you don't have to do that. Like, you got me anyway. You could spend those points on somebody else. he's like, you got me no matter what.
Yeah, he was never changing his mind on that. Yeah. You had, Brenda had something.
Oh, back when Sam was commenting about how Doug would counsel the hi kids or hey kids kind of thing. One of our sons was getting married, and they were kicking around ideas of who they would ask to do the ceremony for them. And I said, well, how about, it was Assemblyman at the time, Assemblyman Doug LaMalfa. They thought, oh, wow, would he really do that? And so I said, well, let's ask. So I did ask him, and he said he would be honored to. But he immediately was like, oh, my gosh, this is really important. And he wanted to counsel with them, so we set up an appointment. The kids were living in Sacramento at the time. He met them and sat down with them and counseled them on all the marriage kinds of things, from finances to togetherness and planning a family and Christian values and all the good stuff. He took that, I thought, just, you know, do the ceremony, thank you.
yeah. Show up, take a bow.
I never realized how seriously he would take that, what an important calling that was for him. And I just was blown away by that. Mm. Just what a loving...
Did they pass? Did he marry him?
Yes, he did.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay. I mean, because I could see him, like, feeling like they weren't ready. And
well, yeah. when I started kicking around the idea of proposing to my wife, he got wind of it, and he...
The old lady?
Yeah, the old lady. my 5'2 old lady. And he called me into his office one day and closed the door, which meant that, like, you were in trouble or something serious was happening, right? He never, like, pulled you into his office and closed the door. And he sat me down, and he asked a million questions about her and a million questions about my readiness. And then he was like, so you're going to take on all these responsibilities. And he listed off sort of all the responsibilities. He didn't know who my wife was. Never met her. But he asked questions that a father would ask to a guy who wanted to marry his daughter. You know, it was like, how are you going to take care of her? Do you have the plan? What are you going to do? When are you going to have kids? How's this? You know, is she a believer? Is she, you know, are you the same on the same team? And then sort of at the end of it, he was like, okay. And I was like, I didn't really ask for your okay. You know, I think I'm in charge of it. But he really, I mean, he treated all of us like his kids. George can attest to that. He especially the girls, when he couldn't walk them home, that would fall to us. You know, D.C.'s a scary place. He would walk Bella to work every morning.
Laura's daughter.
Laura's daughter, yeah. Sometimes to her protest. But he was really concerned about all of us, and I think that's why his death, especially in the D.C. office, hit really hard, because all of us are separated from our families
sure.
in D.C. We're all sort of like islands out there, and he was like our dad, it's just real rough. to go through that. But yeah, no, I thought it was funny. He was like, are you sure that you're going to take care of this girl that I don't know?
Well, he was, you know, the way to really, you know, Doug, he didn't get mad that often. But if somebody was mean to us, like, I mean, you know, the usual, they call and tell us that we suck and some other words I can't use and stuff like that. And that's kind of garden variety. Like, he wasn't going to call all those people up. But if somebody was genuinely dismissive or mean to us as we were trying to do our job and it was uncalled for, all of a sudden, you know. Like
protective.
Super protective. I remember too, he was always really funny about it though. Like I was at a meeting about dam removal up in Siskiyou County, and I'm sitting in the Grange Hall and people there were really mad, and it was long before, you know, the state got involved and all that, but they had basically the pitchforks and the torches were out. They were signs, but they had, you know, pitchforks built onto them, and everybody was pretty, you know, pretty worked up. And I'm texting Doug like the narration of what's happening and what this guy is saying and what people are doing, and this guy is just basically dismissing them and kicking them to the curb, which always made Doug really, you know, it made him really mad. He didn't want his constituents dismissed either. Super pissed about it, and he kept, you know, he was writing back and tell him this, and I was like, you know, raise my hand, and this guy's like, well, does your boss know what you're saying? And I'm like, yeah, it's on my phone right here. He's actually texting me that, and I texted him back. The guy wanted to know if I had permission to say these things, and he writes back, spill as much blood as you can.
I remember that.
I showed it to the county supervisor sitting next to me, and he's like, oh my God. He goes, you have the best job ever. Like, I know. I would do it for free. Oh, I can't tell you how many times I said that. I would do this for free. This is so much fun.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we were empowered to go defend people against the government.
Yeah. I mean, last fire season, I got a text in the middle of the day, and it was like, unleash the dogs or whatever. I know a guy who knows a guy in the Forest Service, and the Forest Service was telling telling him to call me off because Doug's attack dog was a bully. But, you know, nice. That was the thing. You would get, like, spill as much blood.
Yeah.
You get like the green light, and you would just get to go, and it would be to do something. It was never over something, you know, personal. It was like somebody in the district or something.
It was policy abuse.
It was policy abuse. It was fires. Yeah. It was people getting screwed. It was fun. I will say it was fun.
That part.
I just think all the stories we heard yesterday really drove home the point that he genuinely cared about his constituents.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he worried about them all the time.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Worried about him. He'd always ask me, what does so-and-so think of this? How are those guys doing up there? You know, what's going to happen to them? That was always the thing.
Yeah.
When some train wreck was on its way, what's going to happen to them? What can we do? Do we have anything? Do we know anyone?
Yep.
Yeah. It was always the scramble to make sure people weren't crushed under the chariot wheels. Did hate those chariot wheels. Is that on the list? I don't know. Did we leave anything out? We have 2 whole minutes.
One initiation that new legislators had to do when going into Sacramento, they called it a weigh-in, and each person who wanted to participate would weigh in on day one of the legislature, and then they would see. The idea was you're going to gain a lot of weight because you're going to all these rubber chicken dinners and there's all these.
It was literally a weigh-in. Okay.
It was a weigh-in on the scales. And Doug had put on some pounds. And so we were going to Bernie one night for an evening meeting. And he shows up in his red pickup and he was gnawing on a carrot. And I think about this every time I'm cutting carrots or making salad or something. I think of this. He had this hunk of carrot, and he'd take a bite, put it on the dash. We'd go around corners, and that carrot was going back and forth.
I had a muffin that Chet made those travels in my car one time with him, yeah.
He'd get back over within reach. He'd grab it, take a chunk off, put it back on the dash.
So he could pass the weigh-in.
Yeah, don't know how that ever worked
Something
out.
Something changed after that because he had a muffin. It was a chocolate muffin, and it looked really haggard. And, you know, I'm kind of inattentive, so my car's always really clean. And he goes to get in the car, and he's taking all the stuff out of his Mustang, and he's putting it in my car, and then he comes with this muffin. And I'm thinking, no, this muffin's going to be everywhere. And it's like half eaten. I go, oh, maybe we could just leave that here. And he's like, well, no, I had it in D.C., and I had it at home, and I took it to D.C., and then I brought it back. The same muffin had traveled 6,000 miles. I'm like, that is recycling at its peak.
Somebody yesterday was talking about how he would take oil filters back and forth.
Oh, yeah. Change. And I remember the first time he did it. He goes, these filters out here are terrible. He goes, I'm going to take the oil filter back and change the oil in Pearl, the name of the the car. All right, we have to run away. George, Sam, Brenda, Laura, Aaron, Bill, which translates to Jungle George, Sam the Sham, Bun Bun, Landslide Laura, Air Bear, and Willis.
Yeah.
Until next time, this is WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Yesterday, when I was young, the taste of life was sweet, like rain upon my tongue. I teased at life as if it were a foolish game, the way an evening breeze would tease a candle flame. The thousand dreams I dreamed, the splendid things I planned, I always built to last on weak and shifting sand. I lived by night and shunned the naked light of day, and only now I see how the years have run away. Yesterday, when I was young, there were so many songs that waited to be sung, so many wild pleasures that lay in store for me, and so much pain my dazzled eyes refused to see.